Our next case this morning is number 064176, Susan L. Smith against the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Illinois Council 31. Mr. Baker.
Thank you, Judge Ripple. May it please the court. Mr. Jokic. This case is brought under Section 510 of ERISA. Sue Smith was a longtime employee of AFSCME, a union that represents governmental workers. She had been employed by AFSCME for approximately 13 years. In 1998, Sue Smith suffered some fairly serious medical conditions. Largely, she had a brain tumor that was operated on. That brain tumor came back in 2002. It was reoperated on. Now, these events are significant for a couple of reasons. AFSCME provides outstanding medical benefits for its employees. There can be no question about that. But AFSCME is self-insured. It pays all of the claims itself out of its own pocket. Ms. Smith had become a very expensive employee to insure. Furthermore, Ms. Smith, because of her history, it was quite likely that she was going to need further medical treatment in the future. Approximately, actually a little less than 2 weeks after she returned from her second brain surgery, the decision was made, or the decision was brought up to terminate her employment. It was a total of 15 days after she returned that she was in fact terminated. Ms. Smith had been employed by AFSCME for 13 years at that point in time, had never once had any disciplinary issues throughout her tenure with the union. Now, the Lindemann case and the Little case outline what is a prima facie case in this type of a lawsuit, an ERISA retaliation claim. The first two elements are not disputed. It's the third element and final element. That element, according to the Lindemann decision, requires that a plaintiff establish that the employee was discharged or denied employment under circumstances that provides some basis for believing that the prohibited intent to retaliate was present. This is essentially a causation prong, but it's a very minimal one. Some basis for believing that the prohibited intent to retaliate was present. Before the district court, one of the things that we argued was the timing. In fact, on August 11th, Ms. Smith had advised her supervisor, Bob Sarver, that it was likely she was going to need further procedures in the past. She went a step further. She advised him specifically that the surgeon had left a hole in her skull so that when he went back in to do a next brain surgery, he wouldn't have to cut the bone or cut the skull again. Within less than 2 weeks, Mr. Sarver had recommended her termination. We argued to the district court that this timing was highly suspicious. I cited before this court several opinions from this court that have stated that timing standing alone can constitute what is necessary to establish the causation prong of a prima facie case under the McDonnell-Douglas standard. The district court, rather than saying something more than timing is required, essentially stated timing is irrelevant. Court says if we rely on timing, then every case would be suspicious. That's simply not accurate. Timing is highly relevant in retaliation cases. This court on many, many occasions has stated that timing standing alone may be sufficient. Now, go through the Culver decision, the first Spiegla decision, where these issues were addressed. There are also cases from this court, Stone versus Indianapolis, where this court has stated that timing alone is rarely or never sufficient to establish causation. Now, I believe that statement in Stone is wrong, and I believe that this court has clarified it later, but I do believe that the court needs to make a strong pronouncement that timing standing alone is sufficient to establish a prima facie case.
Counsel, the problem here, though, is that even assuming the establishment of a prima facie case, the reason that your client was fired was because she refused to cooperate in a closed-door disciplinary meeting, And it's my understanding that that's undisputed, and there isn't any evidence that that reason was pretextual.
Well, that I disagree with Judge Sykes. And that was the stated reason why my client was discharged. The problem with that stated reason, and again, we've passed the prima facie case, but the problem with that stated reason is, number one, Mr. Sarver had made a recommendation that she be fired before that meeting ever took place.
But he was told he could not implement it by his own supervisor.
He was told he could not implement
it. The termination decision was, at that point, off the table, and they were about to conduct a closed-door disciplinary session when she refused to participate and then was ordered to by Sarver's supervisor, right?
That is essentially correct, procedurally.
So, in other words, there's no dispute that she spoke with Mr. Bayer and understood that she would face disciplinary consequences if she persisted in her refusal to participate in that August 26th meeting?
Well, the dispute, that's essentially correct, Judge Rovner. The dispute is Ms. Smith asked for representation. Ms. Smith asked that the meeting be held with an open door as opposed to a closed door because she had complained of Mr. Sarver harassing her in the past. She indicated she did not feel comfortable participating in that. But the question, and I think the important question for this court to focus on, is the but-for analysis. And but for the medical claims, this meeting never takes place. This meeting takes place and is requested by Mr. Sarver because he maintains, after 13 years of stellar employment, all of a sudden she has become a bad employee. So if it's not for these personnel matters, she's never fired because this meeting is never ordered. It doesn't happen. And again, this is within 2 weeks after the fact. Mr. Sarver writes a memo, handwrites notes where he says to Ms. Smith, "You are more trouble than you are worth." And again, this is an employee who has been there for 13 years. And so the real question isn't, did these incidents occur with the meeting where she did not participate? The question, and the appropriate question, is would she have been fired had she not had the medical conditions that she had?
Now, AFSCME made the point that insofar as Ms. Smith's deposition testimony revealed, when she spoke with Mr. Sarver about her condition on August 11th, she didn't tell him she would likely have to have surgery again in the future. I mean, is that correct?
Possibly. The deposition testimony is somewhat incomplete. The problem with that, Judge Rovner, is at the time that Ms. Smith was pursuing this matter, Ms. Smith was pro se. She was not represented by counsel at that particular deposition. She had no representation. I was not there to clarify it for it. A deposition is a difficult thing for a person to go through. When the summary judgment matter was being reviewed, we submitted, and it's included in the record, a fairly thorough affidavit outlining specifically what had happened. I don't believe that affidavit is inconsistent with her testimony, and I don't think it changes her testimony during her deposition. What I do believe is that the affidavit provides greater detail than what was provided during her deposition testimony.
At what point did you come into the case?
Your Honor, there was an initial summary judgment brief that was filed. I was by Mr. Jokic. I was contacted by the district court, asked if I could represent her in this matter, which I did. At that point in time, the court gave me a window of time, and I don't recall how long it was, maybe 120 days in which to do discovery. At that point in time, I served written discovery, and I took the deposition of three people at AFSCME who had some involvement in the health insurance matters. I contacted some other people who dealt with these who were third parties.
So you took the case pro bono at the request of the district court?
Yes. Judge Sykes, yes, that is essentially correct. The district court contacted me, asked me if this is something I would be interested in. Ms. Smith had requested counsel be provided for her. Court called me, asked me if I would look over the documents. I did. frankly, at this point, I don't remember how Ms. Smith and I got together, but there was some conversation on that. But I was not, whenever Ms. Smith was deposed, I was not involved in that at all. And I was not involved when Mr. Jokic filed his initial summary judgment submission.
So it was basically at the time the summary judgment motion was filed that there was a consideration of the plaintiff's request for counsel. She had been proceeding in forma pauperis pro se up to that point.
Whether it was in forma pauperis, I don't recall, but she was certainly proceeding pro se.
Okay.
I don't recall specifically all the facts. All I know is I received a call from the judge's law clerk who asked me if I would be interested in this matter, and at that point in time, that's how I got involved. I do see that my time has expired. I'm more than happy to answer any further questions if the panel has any. All right. Hi.
Gather not, but Mr. Baker, I will give you 3 minutes for rebuttal. And
okay.
Time comes, okay.
Thank you very much, Judge Ripple.
We'll hear now from Mr. Jokic, and Mr. Jokic, I'm going to enlarge your time by 3 minutes as well.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Steve Jokic, and I represent the defendant appellee in this case, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. What happened in the district court was that after taking the plaintiff's deposition, we filed a motion for summary judgment. The plaintiff responded to the motion for summary judgment. We replied. And at that point, the district court contacted Mr. Baker and brought him into the case. Mr. Baker propounded written discovery, extensive interrogatories, extensive document requests. Thousands of pages of documents were exchanged.
But that deposition had been done already.
That's right. That's right. And the only thing that I can say is we quote the deposition in our statement of facts. We submitted excerpts from the deposition along with our brief. And I think if the court is fair-minded when it reviews a deposition, you'll see that there's no particular taking advantage of the plaintiff in the deposition. She was asked, was there anything else that you can remember that happened in the conversation that took place on the day she returned to work? And she said, well, I remember we talked about the fact that we had 148 emails. But I asked her at the deposition, and I took her through the conversation step by step as best I could. Now, I wish I was a better artist when it came to taking a deposition, and it's not a beautiful transcript the way you might wish it would be for a motion for summary judgment. But it's very clear from that deposition that the plaintiff didn't mention the fact that it was probable, at least in that exchange, that she would be going back for further surgery, although she did mention that there was a bone that had taken up, a piece of bone that had been left out of her skull.
Now, on the prima facie case, why couldn't a jury infer that there might be a causal connection between her illness and the decision to let her go, particularly when she gets fired just 2 weeks after she returns to work and after she's quizzed about her condition by her boss, who allegedly has this history of unusual interest in employees' medical claims?
Well, let me take each piece of that. In terms of the timing, it would be our position that in this case, the timing was not suspicious. The medical plan exists for people to use it. So the fact that people have claims is not a suspicious thing, such as speaking out and being retaliated against in other civil rights or Title VII contexts. And in this particular case, the plaintiff had used the medical plan extensively in 1998, $52,000 claim, in 2000, a $27,000 claim. And there was a gap of 3 months between the time she notified the union that she was going to have surgery in February and the time she actually did have surgery in May. And if there was an intent to keep somebody from having medical claims, the union had plenty of time to retaliate against her during that 3 month period of time and forestall the medical claim that it knew was coming, as opposed to some medical claim that might come down the road. Now, The other piece I think that's really important on that issue is that the evidence is focused at the intent of Mr. Sarver. But Mr. Sarver was not the decision maker in this case. Mr. Baer was the decision maker. Mr. Sarver called Mr. Baer and said, what do I do with this employee? She doesn't want to have a private meeting. And Mr. Baer said, tell her that she needs to close the door on the meeting, that the meeting is not going to be disciplinary in nature. Sue Smith calls Mr. Baer and says, I don't want to have a closed door meeting with Mr. Sarver. Mr. Baer says, I'm the executive director. I'm the head guy in the union. I'm telling you it's not a disciplinary meeting. I close the door for meetings that I have all the time. Go to the meeting and nothing bad will happen to you.
What was the purpose of the meeting?
The purpose of the meeting was to discuss a number of performance issues that had arisen since Ms. Smith had come back to work.
What were those issues?
Well, there were a number of issues. One concerned the calculation of withholding on a back paycheck. Another concerned a memo that Ms. Smith had sent out to retirees of the council that she had sent out under her own name as opposed to Mr. Sarver's name. Another concerned Ms. Smith's use of an emergency vacation day when she didn't have that vacation day in her bank anymore because she'd been out using her time during her period of illness. A whole litany of things like that that Mr. Sarver had concerns about that he wanted to sit down and talk to her about. And Mr. Sarver had gone to Mr. Baer and said, I've got these concerns. And Mr. Baer had said, well, you should sit and have a conversation. You should make sure that she has noticed what the concerns are so that nobody can say later that they didn't know what was expected of them.
Was she expressly advised that she would be fired if she refused to participate in that meeting, or was she merely told she would be disciplined? And does that make any difference?
I don't think it makes any difference, Your Honor, because it's clear from the record that she was told that severe discipline could result.
Severe.
That's right. It's not so clear whether the word termination was used, although I think the best reading of the evidence in the record was that she knew that she could be fired for not attending the meeting.
If that's not explicit, isn't that a jury question?
I don't think so, Your Honor. She knew that discipline could result. That much is undisputed. And she never said, give me another chance, please let me come back to the meeting. Instead, when she was terminated, she left. And I don't think it's a jury question. I mean, the issue is the intent of the decision maker. And the decision maker, I think very clearly in this instance, was Mr. Baer. And since it was Mr. Baer, they have an obligation to show that he had some retaliatory intent. There's no evidence that Mr. Baer knew that Ms. Smith might be going for future surgery. There's no evidence that he had any undue interest in anybody's medical bill. Instead, the only evidence was that he instructed the plaintiff to go to a meeting and she refused. And given that, regardless of whether you believe that timing can get you to a prima facie case, it can't get you over the hump of having a legitimate non-discriminatory reason for the discipline of the termination that was administered in this case. In the usual case where you're saying that a subordinate's discriminatory intent is something that you can hold the organization liable for, you'll have a situation where the subordinate misrepresented something or acted as a gatekeeper to the person who made the decision. But that wasn't the case in this particular instance because Mr. Baer knew all of the facts that were going on in that morning. And there is no evidence that he had any retaliatory intent at all. And as a consequence, you can't get to the point that they need to get to in order to establish a violation of Section 510 of ERISA. And therefore, I think that the district court's decision in this respect, which is a very thorough decision, went through all the evidence, I think it should be upheld.
Is this sort of an offense, typically a firing offense? Refusal to close the door in a non-disciplinary meeting?
The record is silent on that exact point, Your Honor. The plaintiff concedes that the plaintiff's counsel concedes that the plaintiff was insubordinate. He also concedes that this is the type of insubordination that you could be disciplined or terminated for in his brief. This situation doesn't come up very often where you ask somebody to close the door and they won't even close the door. And so what I would say, Your Honor, is what happened here is that the plaintiff made it impossible for the defendant to do business on the issues the defendant wanted to do business on. The defendant wanted the meeting to be private. I think that is a very reasonable request. It's reasonable both from the standpoint of the defendant's stake, so that the other people that have to work during that day aren't embroiled in the conversation. And it's also reasonable from the plaintiff's point of view, because there may be confidential things that come up in the meeting. And the flat insubordination here, the no, I won't do what you tell me, that is something that an organization can't tolerate in terms of running the organization and in terms of administering its personnel policy. So I would say, bottom line, in response to your question, Your Honor, that although the situation doesn't come up very often, the flat failure to follow an order is usually something that can get you fired. And that's why the rule is usually follow an order and grieve later. That allows both sides to proceed with their business. That wasn't able to be done in that case, and that's why we came to the result that we came to.
Thank you, Mr. Jokic. How much time does Mr. Baker have? 3 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Judge Ripple. I appreciate your consideration in allowing me a few additional moments.
Can you help us out with whether there is any evidence of pretext here?
Well, I believe that there is evidence of pretext. Number one, the person who was behind all of this, Mr. Sarver, had requested the week before that she be fired. And that request, to me, instant questions what's motivating him. And this is a person, again, Judge Ripple, who had been there for 13 years, no discipline whatsoever, not even a statement, you're not doing a good job, Sue. All of a sudden, she comes back, and in a span of 2 weeks, they have all of these problems that supposedly are arising. Mr. Sarver, according to Ms. Smith, had been hostile towards her. She was nervous about meeting with Mr. Sarver under those conditions. I believe that is sufficient evidence of pretext. And again, the question on pretext isn't, was Sue Smith insubordinate? That's not the question. The question is that the real reason for the termination? And when we look at it in a but-for analysis, and that's really the question, but for her going to these medical doctors or having the medical procedures, she would not have been retaliated against.
Is there any evidence that Mr. Baer knew of the status of the insurance claims?
No.
And the amount of the insurance claims?
There's no evidence. He certainly knew that she had been out for a significant period of time for medical reasons. As far as knowing that she would be coming back, no. But the reality is, Mr. Baer made the decision, but Mr. Baer didn't make the decision in a vacuum. Rather, it was Mr. Sarver who initially the Friday before had asked that she be fired, and Baer said no. It was on that Tuesday when Baer and Sarver were discussing what was going to be done, where Mr. Sarver said, I want her fired. He was the one who recommended firing, and Baer said, okay, she's your subordinate. So the recommendation, the push for the termination, came from Sarver. He is the one with the retaliatory animus. He is the one with the retaliatory intent. He is the one who was pushing it. Again, these things never get there, never get to that level, unless it's for Mr. Sarver.
I thought Baer told Sarver he couldn't fire her and then only gave the termination order after the incident of insubordination.
On the Friday, Sarver had requested to fire. Baer said, no, you need to sit her down and talk to her about these issues. On the Tuesday, where they had the meeting that was set, at that point in time, Sarver and Baer had the conversations about the fact that she would not sit down with him. At that point in time, it was Sarver again who said, I want to fire her. And at that point in time, Baer said, okay. And I do, and I, if I could just answer or address one more issue, and I think this was an issue that you raised, Judge Rovner, and it was about the discipline level that she had been told about. In his deposition, Mr. Bayer discusses that, and he told her, and it's on the supplemental appendix on pages 65 and 66. We want you to understand what changes we expect of you and what that we are telling you have the right to go into that room and that we are going to close the door. And then if you don't, there will be discipline imposed. No statement of you will be fired, just there will be discipline that is imposed.
Mr. Baker, a moment ago in talking with us, you suggested that this might be a dual motive case, that the decision to fire her really was because, one, she was getting pricey as far as her medical work was concerned, and two, she was becoming somewhat disruptive in the office. But that the decision to fire wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for the medical expenses. They may have taken lesser discipline if those office performance issues were the only things around. Did you make that argument at all to the district court?
I believe that I did, Judge Ripple. I don't know that I necessarily articulated it in that particular fashion, but I do believe what I argued to the district court was, again, this but-for analysis, and that is unless there's the medical issue, we don't have the supposed performance issues that lead to this ultimate ultimate termination, and that's really where I'm coming from. In my opinion, what happened here is Bob Sarver looked at this from a financial perspective. He looked at Sue Smith and said she's going to cost us a lot of money down the road, and at that point in time, he did what he needed to get rid of her. It took him 2 weeks, but he was able to accomplish that. And I believe that even if she had sat through that meeting, based upon the animosity that he had shown to her, it was only a matter of time before she was going to be fired. And I believe that those are questions. The evidence there is sufficient for a finder of fact to make that determination.
I'm sorry, please.
So it's your argument that there were no problems with her performance. In other words, you don't allege in any way that if there were problems with performance, they were due to her illness. That's not part of this case.
No, I mean there were some minor, I don't want to say trivial, but essentially trivial issues that one I think that had come up. There were some other things that we believe weren't really valid issues that Mr. Sarver went through, and we went through his deposition at length discussing those things. Mm-hmm. But she made a mistake, one mistake that was insignificant, that was corrected within 24 hours, and you know the meeting came sufficiently after that. So all employees make mistakes from time to time. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's cause for a sit-down meeting to address all of these issues. Again, she had been there for 13 years. She knew her job. Her mental condition because of her surgery in no way impacted upon her ability to do her job at that point in time. Have I addressed everyone's questions?
I think so. Thank you, Mr. Baker.
Thank you again very much.
Thanks also to you, Mr. Jokic, and the case will be taken under advisement.